White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to our International Jew Study Hour, our 1 hour a week in which we are coming, me, Carolyn Yeager, and with me, having Scott from our studios in the White Network and at the White Network, and bringing you this very, very interesting book. And we don't have too many listeners yet, but that's we hope they will accumulate, because we have a good one tonight. We are going to finish up what we didn't finish last week in from chapter 11. The title of that was Jewish Estimate of Gentile Human Nature, and we've got a little more of that to do. And then we will begin with chapter 12, which is Jewish Protocols Claim Partial Fulfillment. So, good evening, Hadding.
Hello.
Do we want to give a little review of what we did last week? Not too much. It was about the Jewish estimate of Gentile human nature, and of course it was that the Gentile. It was all about it, and we're still not done with it. But it's all about how the Gentiles are so stupid and easy to manipulate and fool that they have been able to cause us to go whatever direction they want us to go, and they talk about their successes in that. Isn't that pretty much the way it was?
Something like that.
Okay. And so where we stopped was talking about family life, and that was one area that they were going to,
the broader topic there was the use of ideas as poison. And it says
right.
that they teach ideas that they know to be wrong to the young goyim. And then it says that this extends also to family life.
Right. You want to start there?
Well,
it's just a little bit above where we ended. Just
it
slightly.
Extends to family life.
Okay, and while you're looking for that,
are we gonna do the switcheroo thing here?
Yeah, and I want to
see my Jew voices are not evil enough, so Carolyn has to read them.
Yeah, well, I was telling Hadding, as I've said, that when he reads with his Jew voice, it sounds too much like it's just a stupid Jew and not evil enough, or not putting across the seriousness of their intentions.
Yeah.
So I said, then I got the idea. Maybe I should. Read that part so that it would be clear that was, one was a quote from the protocols and the other wasn't. And he didn't have any problem with that. And I tried it out, and he thought I sounded more evil than
he. Yes, very evil.
Okay. So we're going to try that. We'll see. I'll do my best.
Okay. It extends to family life.
Well, I don't have that part.
Okay.
So you have to read that one.
All right. Well, it's... Okay, well, we left off where it says, the poison of an idea is their most relied on weapon. The plan of thus using ideas extends to education. We have misled, stupefied, and demoralized the youth of the Gentiles by means of education in principles and theories, patently false to us, but which we have inspired. That's Protocol 9. It extends also to family life. Having in this way inspired everybody with the thought of his own importance, we will break down the influence of family life among the Gentiles and its educational importance. Protocol 10. And in a passage which might well provide the material for long examination and contemplation by the thoughtful reader, this is said.
Until the time is ripe, let them amuse themselves. Let those theories of life which we have induced them to regard as the dictates of science play the most important role for them. To this end, we shall endeavor to inspire blind confidence in these theories by means of our press. Continues. Note the successes we have arranged in Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism. The demoralizing effect of these doctrines upon the minds of the Gentiles should be evident at least to us.
No.
Protocol 2.
Yeah, that's Protocol 2. But I have a problem with this. Mm-hmm. Because Marxism, you can argue that that's an expression of the Jewish conspiracy, although Marx used a lot of ideas that were already floating around. But the Darwinism and Nietzscheism are really just criticisms, fairly obvious. I mean, they're really based on what are, in retrospect, fairly obvious criticisms of assumptions that had prevailed for a long time. Darwinism is based on observation. And I think Darwinism and Nietzsche's criticisms together really help, at least potentially help, to put society on a more solid footing. It put the Western man on a more solid footing. But if this section was plagiarized, one of those sections that was plagiarized from Maurice Joly.
Well, we should know. Shouldn't we know whether it was one of those sections that was before you bring that up? Did you find out if that's one of the plagiarized, if this was in Joly?
Well,
probably something like this was. Yeah, it would make sense.
Because you've got the anti-Christian aspect of all three of these things.
Well, that's the thing. That's what they have in common.
Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism.
Right. And I think that's why they're in here.
With Darwin and with Nietzsche, you get the biological view of man, which really means the racial view of humanity.
Well, you know, but my question was, who is most against these three things? And my answer was Christians and maybe monarchists, you know, don't like this. But, you know, this is anti-Christian. So that both Joly anti-Christian?
No. According to what you read last week, he was.
But he's saying that this is the Jews speaking. So we know the Jews are. You know, the Jews are being presented as anti-Christian.
Yeah, supposedly supporting Darwin and Nietzsche as well as Marx.
Right, right. Okay, and you disagree with that as
I'm saying that the protocol. Rather conveniently reflective of a Christian perspective.
Well, it's reflective of... that they are going after that. It's reflective of a Christian perspective.
And I don't believe it says, note the successes we have arranged in Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism. No, Jews are responsible for Darwin. Jews are responsible for Nietzsche. I don't think so. There's a Danish philosopher named Kierkegaard, mm-hmm. who was in some ways similar to Nietzsche, but he did never abandon Christianity as such, but he did criticize the church quite a lot. And he had a Jewish backer. I don't remember his name, but he had some Jewish publisher that supported him a lot. You know, so some of these people that look like they're stirring things up, the Jews will get behind them and push them a bit. But Jews did not create Darwin. Jews did not create Nietzsche. And ultimately, if Darwinism and Nietzsche, the insights that they provide, are used in an intelligent way, they put us on a more solid footing.
Okay. All right. Well put. So let's go on then.
All right. That this disintegration and division of Gentile society was proceeding at a favorable rate when the protocols were uttered is evident from every line of them. For it must be remembered that the protocols are not bidding for support of a proposed program, but are announcing progress on a program which has been in process of fulfillment for centuries and from ancient times.
Those are in quotes, because that comes from the protocols themselves.
For centuries and from ancient times. They contain a series of statements regarding things accomplished, as well as a forelook at things yet to be accomplished. The split of Gentile society was very satisfactorily proceeding in 1896 or thereabouts, when these oracles were uttered. It is to be noticed that the purpose is nowhere stated to be the extermination of the Gentiles, but their subjugation. At first, under the invisible rule which is proposed in these documents, at length under the rule of one whom the invisible forces would be able to put in control of the world through political changes which would create an office of world president or autocrat, the Gentiles are to be subdued, first intellectually, as here shown, and then economically. Nowhere is it hinted that they are to be deprived of the earth, but only of their independence, of those whom the protocols represent to be Jews. How far the division of society had proceeded when these protocols were given may be gathered from the fifth protocol.
A world coalition of Gentiles could cope with us temporarily, but we are assured against this by roots of dissension among them so deep that they cannot be torn out. We have created antagonism between the personal and national interests of the Gentiles by arousing religious and race hatreds, which we have nourished in their hearts for 20 centuries.
Yeah, that's, that's certainly true of race relations in the United States. The Jews did stir up the blacks and organize them. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that this has been going on for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like taking that. A lot of credit for everything here. And you're pointing that out. That's good, because they are, say, they've been nourishing that for 20 centuries.
Yeah.
Between these interests. Although you can read things in which, you don't know that is the reason that they're doing what they're doing. Mostly it's financial. Seems like most of the reason for them doing whatever they were doing that goes way back in time, maybe it does go back 20 centuries, but it was always them trying to make as much money as possible. And also to get along, to protect themselves in these other people's nations that they were in, and in empires and so on, by working things up, you know, in any opportunity that they had to create dissension among non-Jewish people, they would do it. But I don't know that that was just a byproduct of their trying to protect themselves, So that, because what they were doing as far as their money interests went, and they were always good at making money, was they were making these Gentiles very, very angry. And so in order to detract the anger away from themselves, they would try to get them angry at one another. So in that way, you could say that they probably were doing that all this time, but not on the scale that they started doing it in more recent times.
Yeah.
They didn't do anything on the scale they're doing now, which is, mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's pretty good of me, right? Okay, go ahead.
All right. As far as that concerns the dissensions of the Gentiles or Christian world, it is absolutely true. And we have seen in our own nation how the antagonism between personal and national interests have rested on religious and race hatreds. But whoever suspected a common source for these? More amazing still, who would expect any man or group to avow themselves the source? Yet it is thus written in the protocols. We have created the antagonism. We thus assure ourselves against the possibility of a Gentile coalition against us. And whether these protocols are of Jewish origin or not, whether they represent Jewish interests or not, this is exactly the state of the world, of the Gentile world today. Now, see there, he's earlier in the International Jew, he was saying that it was not at all clear whether the protocols were authentic or not, which is what Nihilus also said. But now it's getting closer to affirming that they're authentic, which is not a good move.
Well, I don't know. I think they're saying whether they are of Jewish origin or not, okay, this is the state of the world, of the Gentile world today. This is my position. I think that it's not important to determine whether they are of Jewish origin or if they represent Jewish interests, but what whoever wrote them, and for whatever reason, they do show us the state of the world, and they show how this stuff is done, and we know it's being done.
Well, look at the sentence.
It's been done.
Look at the sentence in the middle of that paragraph. More amazing still, who would expect any man or group to avow themselves the source? Now, if a particular statement is amazing, and you can't believe that somebody would say such a thing.
They're talking about the source. Who would avow themselves the source? The Jews are not. He's talking about why would the Jews say we're the source of this? They don't say that. They say they're not.
No, it says, we have created the antagonism. We assure ourselves against the possibility of a Gentile coalition against us. That's what the protocols say. See, this was William Pierce's criticism of the protocols, is that it's too direct. It's too direct. It avows too much.
Okay, and as I say, it may be, and therefore they may not be of the source that so many people want to believe they are, or that nihilist thought, or that story went out. But they still exist, and they still tell us the state of the world, and they tell us what's been going on, don't they? I mean, they do. So that's
in
what's important. That's why I think they're important. They're important for people to be aware of, and I think if they were presented in that way, and you could get people to pay more attention to them, people would learn an awful lot, because when you read it, you recognize what's happening. I mean, that's the experience I had. That's why it's so scary, because you read this and then you recognize, gee, they are doing this. Now, maybe it's some kind of a trick of writing or something, but we need to be educated in this. And to say that this is not stuff that we need to know, that would be wrong. So that's my position. I think that's a pretty safe position to have. And really the only one, and I think that's what they're saying here. Although they are more inclined to want to believe that they're Jewish, but they do admit that, you know, it's not proven. And they are therefore saying whether they are or not, they still have something to teach us. I agree with that. Okay.
But a still deeper division is aimed for, and there are signs of even this coming to pass. Indeed, in Russia, it has already come to pass. The spectacle of a Gentile lower class led by Jewish leaders against a Gentile upper class. In the first protocol, describing the effects of a speculative industrial system upon the people, it is said that this sort of economic folly
has already created and will continue to create a society which is disillusioned, cold, and heartless. Such a society is completely estranged from politics and religion. Lust of gold will be the only guide of the people. Then, not for the sake of good, nor even for the sake of riches, but solely on account of their hatred of the privileged classes, the lower classes of the Gentiles will follow us in the struggle against our rivals for power, the Gentiles of the intellectual classes. So he is saying, no, is there more? The lower classes of the Gentiles will follow us against the Gentiles of the intellectual classes.
Yeah, repeated for emphasis.
That's repeated for emphasis.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
If that struggle were to occur today, the leaders of the Gentile insurgents against Gentile society would be Jewish leaders. They are in the leader's place now, not only in Russia, but also in the United States. And it closes with a quote here. There is all the difference in the world, said a young Jewish.
I thought that's part of chapter 12.
Well, no, it's not. This comes before the number of the next chapter, but could be.
Oh, it's a part of it, I think. Because this this says well, here that you're part independent. This. Yeah, there's three quotes there to begin that thing.
All right.
Yeah, three of them.
I'll go ahead and read this.
Okay, go ahead.
This is from a book called The Conquering Jew, page 91. There is all the difference in the world, said a young Jewish philosopher, between an American Jew and a Jewish American. A Jewish American is a mere amateur Gentile, doomed to be a parasite forever. And that was, I found out, The Conquering Jew was published in 1915, and the author was John Foster Fraser, who was an Englishman that traveled around the world on a bicycle. And
yeah.
gave lectures after that.
And he wrote, he wrote this book. He was an anti-Semite.
Well, I don't know what else is in that book. He wrote about what he had seen in, he wrote and gave talks about what he had seen in Russia, for one thing.
Yeah, but anyway, he makes a good point here that there's a difference between an American Jew and a Jewish American. Yeah. There aren't any Jewish Americans. There's only American Jews, as far as I know.
I suppose he's quoting someone that he encountered on his travels.
Yeah, maybe one person who called himself a Jewish American.
All right. Now we're up to chapter 12.
Yes, and so that was a good finish there, and so... chapter 12 is Jewish protocols claim partial fulfillment. And what they're saying throughout this chapter is that it has been partially fulfilled already. And that the protocols are claiming. This chapter is really all about what they say they've already done or what they are doing. It's all in the present tense, right, Hattie?
Present perfect, I guess.
Well, yeah, whatever.
Have already done.
Well, sometimes they say, no, it's just, they say, we are, we have, they just put it in this plain old present tense that, they're now doing this stuff. They are doing it.
Present progressive, then.
Okay.
Jewish protocols claim partial fulfillment.
Okay, I got to read the protocol. With the present instability of all authority, our power will be more unassailable than any other. Because it will be invisible until it has gained such strength that no cunning can undermine it. Protocol 1. Now from Protocol 2, they have another quote. It is indispensable for our purposes that, as far as possible, wars should bring no territorial advantages. This will shift war to an economic footing. Such a condition of affairs will place both sides under the control of our international agents with their million eyes, whose vision is unhampered by any frontiers. Then our international rights will eliminate national rights in the narrow sense and will govern the governments as they govern their subjects.
Yes.
Protocol 2.
Very scary. As a mere literary curiosity, these documents, which are called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, would exercise a fascination by reason of the terrible completeness of the world plan which they disclose. But they discourage at every turn the view that they are literature. They purport to be statesmanship, and they provide within their own lines the clue by which their status may be determined. Besides the things they look forward to doing, they announce the things they have done and are doing. If, in looking about the world, it is possible to see both the established conditions and the strong tendencies to which these protocols allude, it will not be strange if interest in a mere literary curiosity gives way to something like alertness, and it may be alarm.
So, what I got from that is that these writers in Henry Ford and his group, they still had this high expectations that that bringing these protocols to light was going to really open up this whole discussion and make people aware of things they had not, shine the light on it. And they really did. Although, the Jews have their way. They were a stronger opponent than he expected or that he thought they were or could be. And, you know, they were a stronger opponent than Adolf Hitler and his crowd or his group of National Socialists thought, too, especially in the beginning. They thought,
mainly because Americans
were going to do them in.
Mainly because Americans were foolish enough to do what the Jews wanted them to do.
Well, so, and so did the British. They all did. But this is what they had a way, and the Jews were able to get the Americans here, you know, in the 20s and 10s and so on, to do what they wanted, too. This is something we need to understand, and I don't think there's very few that really understand how powerful or what a formidable enemy these Jews are, and what they have in mind, too. And even though some people kind of overrate their evilness, you know, and their, you know, beastliness and so on, but they don't really they're not being seriously, you know, understanding how do you go about protecting yourself, and how do you go about dealing with them, or not fighting them so much, but resisting them and asserting your own interests. Very, very difficult. But it could be done if people would really understand. Well, they thought that if they made all this stuff available in the book, The International Jew, all the things they were letting out, it would do it. But, you know, the Jews were able to make them look like bad people, anti-Semites, and so on. I want to tell the listeners that I do have my email up now, and if you want to write a question or comment about the show, you can do so. I'm looking at it right now. So, all right. Oh, now okay. I got you. No, it's your turn.
All right. A few general quotations will serve to illustrate the element of present achievement in the assertions of these documents. And in order that the point may be made clear to the reader, the key words will be emphasized. Take this from Protocol 9.
Okay, I'm going to emphasize the key words. In reality, there are no obstacles before us. Our super government has such an extra legal status that it may be called by the energetic and strong word dictatorship. I can conscientiously say that at the present time, we are the lawmakers. We create courts and jurisprudence. We rule with a strong will because we hold in our hands the remains of a once strong party now subjugated by us.
And this from the Eighth Protocol.
We will surround our government with a whole world of economists. It is for this reason that the science of economics was the chief subject of instruction taught by the Jews.
Yeah, is the chief subject of instruction.
Is the chief subject. Yeah. Thank you. We shall be surrounded by a whole galaxy of bankers, industrialists, capitalists, and especially by millionaires, because actually everything will be decided by an appeal to figures. That's an interesting.
These are strong claims, but not too strong for the facts that can be marshaled to illustrate them. They are, however, but an introduction to further claims that are made and equally paralleled by the facts. All through the protocols, as in this quotation from the Eighth, the preeminence of the Jews in the teaching of political economy is insisted upon, and the facts bear that out. They are the chief authors of those vagaries which lead the mob after economic impossibilities, and they are also the chief teachers of political economy in our universities, the chief authors of those popular textbooks in the subject which hold the conservative classes to the fiction that economic theories are economic laws. The idea, the theory, as instruments of social disintegration are common to both the university Jew and the Bolshevik Jew. When all this is shown in detail, public opinion upon the importance of academic and radical economics may undergo a change.
Okay, I'm going to break in here because I looked up a few things. I was trying to find out how many economists were Jews. I know there's a lot of them, but I thought, well, is it that high as in other fields? Because there's a lot of non-Jewish economists, or there used to be, but I'm kind of wondering if there still are, because I found out that Jews currently constitute over 40% of the membership of the Economic Sciences Division of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. and recipients of the Nobel Prize in Economics, 41% of them are Jewish. And recipients of the John Bates Clark Medal in Economics, another important award, 65% of recipients have been Jewish. So that they are predominant in economics.
Well, that's true in the Anglo-American milieu. In the Germans have their own school of economics that's rather different. German economics is based on a nationalist viewpoint, starting with Friedrich List. They think in terms, their economics is calculated on the basis of viewing the economy as a servant of the nation and as a way to secure the survival of the nation.
Still? They still do that?
Yeah, the Germans still have their own schools of economics that are different from the way people over here look at the economies. The dominant economics over here are Keynesianism and monetarism. Probably the dominant economic view in Germany right now is the Freiburg School. I don't know much about that. But, their whole way of looking at economics is different.
Well, I've been told by Germans that who live in Germany that that there aren't that many Jews, known Jews in Germany, but Jews don't call themselves Jews. I mean, they call themselves Germans in Germany, and a lot of them get rid of their real Jewish-sounding names. So there's a lot of Jews around, but they're not even described as Jews. I mean, they come across, and everybody takes them for Germans. So, but I think that in a lot of fields, there are not as many Jews in Germany as there are, like, in the U.S.
Yeah.
At all. So
well, as I said, they have a whole different view of economics.
That's good.
The party in Germany that represents what we consider to be economic conservatism in the USA is I think it's called the Free Democratic Party. They've been on the decline recently. They don't have as many representatives in the parliament as they used to have. A very relatively small party now.
Okay.
And as claimed in the quotation just given from the Ninth Protocol, the Jewish world power does today constitute a super government. It is the protocol's own word, and none is more fitting. No nation can get all that it wants, but the Jewish world power can get all that it wants, even though its demands exceed Gentile equality. We are the lawmakers, say the protocols, and Jewish influences have been lawmakers in a greater degree than any but the specialists realize. In the past 10 years, Jewish international rule, or the power of the group of international Jews, has quite dominated the world. More than that, it has been powerful enough to prevent the passage of salutary laws, and where one law may have slipped through to a place on the statute books, it has been powerful enough to get it interpreted in a sense that rendered it useless for its purpose. This, too, can be illustrated by a large collection of facts.
Well, now, this is Henry Ford writers who are saying that this is going on currently in the past 10 years. Jews have quite dominated the world. So they're talking about, again, World War I years, and the aftermath especially. But they're talking about 1910 to 1920. And they're very aware of that, of the Jewish power that came out, particularly at the Paris peace talks. They've talked about that in the past, and how they got their way in every way. So, I think that's important. It's good what they're saying there.
Moreover, the method by which this is done was outlined long ago in the program of which the protocols purport to be an outline. We create courts, continues the quotation, and it is followed in other protocols by numerous references to our judges. There is a Jewish court sitting in a public building in the city of New York every week, and other courts for the sole advantage and use of this people, whose spokesmen deny that they are a separate people, are in formation everywhere. The Zionist plan has already been used in some of the smaller European countries to confer an extra citizenship upon Jews who already enjoy citizenship in the lands of their residence, and in addition to that, a degree of self-rule under the very governments which they demand to protect them. Wherever Jewish tendencies are permitted to work unhindered, the result is not Americanization, nor Anglicization, nor any other distinctive nationalism, but a strong and ruling reversion back to essential Judaization.
Well, I want to bring up here that when they're talking about the self-rule that Jews are given under these governments that they demand to protect them, they're talking about Gentile governments, European governments, and so on. They have historically, the Jews, for some, well, I know why, have been given a high degree of self-rule by Gentile princes and governors and kings and so on, and they've received special privileges. I'm reading this essay, long essay by Alfred Rosenberg about the track of the Jews through the ages. So it's fresh in my mind that all these examples he gives of in Europe where the Jews somehow have more influence over their leaders, over their rulers, than the Christians did. And the reason for that is clear, that the Jews always found some way to help out these princes and governors and rulers and kings and so on financially. And so they gave them what they wanted. And sometimes it was quite blatant, you know, until the Christians were so ripped off by these Jews, and they got so mad. And finally, they would actually, you know, little by little, they'd build up to it, and then they'd have a big riot or something, and then the rulers would have to do, sometimes they would actually then turn against the Jews, kick them out, and so on. But they always came back. I mean, no, this has always been going on, and it's still going on now. Why do the Jews have all this control in Gentile society? Because they do favors. They help the elites, the people who can do that for them, right? I'd say basically.
Yeah, they had the separate Jewish courts even in the Roman Empire.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They gave them. That's just one thing, the separate courts. The other is all these privileges they got to do things that the Christians weren't allowed to do, and of course their usury. They were always getting to okay to charge higher and higher percent. You know, 50%. However that was figured back then, but 50% was common. That was not unusual. What was unusual when they got up close to, 100% or over 100%. I mean, things we couldn't even believe today they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they are actually robbing all these hardworking Christian farmers and so on, who sometimes had to borrow money. There were these Jews willing to loan it to them, and then they'd get into hock so bad they'd lose all their property. That's how these Jews got rich over time, over all these centuries. They accumulated more and more and more of what at one time belonged to us.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Boy, that can make me mad.
Yeah, well, partial reserve banking is a way to get rich in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
If you can lend out 10 times as much money as you actually have, and the money that you're lending out wasn't yours in the first place, that's easy money.
I guess they figured out a way to do it, what they used to do with their 100% interest and so on. They figured out a way to do it that we wouldn't know, you know, with this reserve banking and so on. So, you know, they could say, oh, you pay an interest of 5% or 2% or something, when actually it's not that way at all. They've got it all hidden.
Okay. The agents referred to in the first quotation will receive attention in another article. To resume the claims of the protocols, this is from the 7th protocol.
We have taken good care long ago to discredit the Gentile clergy and thereby to destroy their mission, which at present might hamper us considerably. Their influence over the people diminishes daily. Freedom of conscience has never been proclaimed everywhere. Consequently, it
no,
is
no,
only...
No, no, no,
no. Has been. I'm sorry, you're right. Freedom of conscience has been proclaimed everywhere. Consequently, it is only a question of time when the complete crash of the Christian religion will occur. It will be easier to handle the other religions, but it is too early to discuss this phase of the subject.
See, what he's saying there is that religious tolerance will cause the destruction of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's saying there. That will be important to bear in mind later.
Okay.
This will be of considerable interest, perhaps, to those clergymen who are laboring with Jewish rabbis to bring about some kind of religious union. Such a union would of necessity dispose of Christ as a well-meaning but wholly mistaken Jewish prophet, and thus distinctive Christianity would cease to exist insofar as the union was effective. The principal religious aversion of the protocols, however, so far as it is expressed, is against the Catholic Church in general and the pontifical office in particular. See, there it's got this Catholic perspective.
Who has the Catholic perspective? The protocols? Ford and his people were not Catholics.
I know that.
So what do you mean by that it has the Catholic
perspective? The principal religious aversion of the protocols is against the Catholic Church in general.
Oh.
And the pontifical office in particular.
Well, so, for the Jews have always known that it's the Catholic Church that is their strongest opponent, not the watered-down Protestant Church. Well, and it's the Protestant Church that brought on the Old Testament stuff, making us part of the Jewish Brotherhood or something like that. Well, I don't want to get into that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that makes sense because the Catholic Church was much more anti-Jewish than the Protestant.
Well, it also makes sense if you consider that this would have been Jolie's perspective.
Yeah, okay.
A curious paragraph in this protocol claims for the Jewish race a particular skill in the art of insult.
Our contemporary press will expose governmental and religious affairs and the incapacity of the Gentiles, always using expressions so derogatory as to approach insult, the faculty of employing which is so well known to our race.
This is from the fifth protocol.
I was going to ask you, what do you make of that? What I just... Well, that, you know, that they
well,
say...
Well, it's just...
They say that they really know how to insult. That's what they're saying.
Yeah,
so
well
known,
if you,
you
ever
know,
got into a dispute with a Jew, you'll hear... Foul language that was quite inventive sometimes.
Okay, well, I've never gotten into that.
Yeah, they really get into the foul language.
Yeah.
But, I don't know.
Well, I don't know if that's what they're going to hear, but they know how to tear their non-Jews down, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's the faculty that they are proud of and that they have. Okay.
Apparently. This is from the fifth protocol.
Under our influence, the execution of the laws of the Gentiles is reduced to a minimum. Respect for law is undermined by the liberal interpretation we have introduced in this sphere. The courts decide as we dictate, even in the most important cases in which are involved, fundamental principles or political issues, viewing them in the light in which we present them to the Gentile administration through agents with whom we have apparently nothing in common, through newspaper opinion and other avenues. In Gentile society, where we have planted discord and Protestantism.
Okay, this is what Ford's writers say. The word Protestantism is evidently not used in the religious or sectarian sense, but to denote a temper of querulous fault-finding destructive of harmonious collective opinion. Now, he's just told us that the general orientation of the protocols is anti-Catholic. It represents an anti-Catholic conspiracy. It represents hostility toward Catholicism. But here where it mentions planting Protestantism and discord, we're going to pretend that it doesn't mean literal Protestantism in the sense of...
Well, he doesn't, because it's written with the lower class P, and it's Protestantism.
That's how it's written here.
Yeah, Protestantism, and that is what Protestantism comes from the word protest. Anyway, because they were protesting against the...
You know, they don't have lowercase letters in the Russian language.
Well, anyway... I don't know. But one thing I do want to mention about this quote from the Fifth Protocol is that, you know, and I was trying to emphasize the present tense. Gentiles, the laws of the Gentiles is reduced. The courts decide as we dictate. We present them to the, you know, it's all what they're doing right now. And this is the big emphasis that at least the International Jew wants to make in this chapter, that it's all about what they are doing now. Not what they're going to do in the future.
Okay. Well, to me, it's just blatantly obvious that it means religious Protestantism, and that Ford is trying to interpret this away because it's inconvenient for him.
I don't think so, because this is in the... Now, wait a minute. This is in the protocol. The protocols, it says, in Gentile society, where we have planted discord and Protestantism.
Protestantism.
Now, we don't know. This was translated from something. We don't know what that original word was, do we? Why it was translated into Protestantism. Because I know that Protestantism in the beginning was, we're the protesters, Protestants, and so on. It meant protest. It wasn't a peculiarly religious word as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, well, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. It's another chalk.
From a Catholic perspective, Protestantism and sowing discord are the same thing. Okay. This is from the 14th protocol.
Okay. In countries called advanced, we have created a senseless, filthy, and disgusting literature. For a short time after our entrance into power, we shall encourage its existence so that it may show in greater relief the contrast between it and the written and spoken announcements which will emanate from us.
Discussing in the 12th protocol the control of the press, a subject which must be treated more extensively in another article, the claim is made.
We have attained this at the present time to the extent that all news is received through several agencies in which it is centralized from all parts of the world. These agencies will then be, to all intents and purposes, our own institutions, and will publish only that which we permit. Now, that couldn't be more true.
This from the 7th protocol bears on the same subject.
We must force the Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan, already approaching its triumphant goal, by bringing to bear the pressure of stimulated public opinion which has been organized by us with the help of the so-called great power of the press. With a few exceptions not worth considering, it is already in our hands.
To resume the 12th protocol.
If we have already managed to dominate the mind of Gentile society to such a point that almost all see world affairs through the colored lenses of the spectacles which we place before their eyes, and if now there is not one government with barriers erected against our access to that which by Gentile stupidity is called state secrets, what then will it be when we are the recognized masters of the world? in the person of our universal ruler.
The Jewish nation is the only nation that possesses the secrets of all the rest. No nation long protects a secret which directly concerns another nation, but even so, no nation has all the secrets of all the other nations. Yet, it is not too much to say that the international Jews have this knowledge. Much of it, of course, amounts to nothing, and their possession of it does not materially add to their power. But the fact that they have the access, that they can get whatever they want when they want it, is the important point. As many a secret paper could testify if it could talk, and many a custodian of secret papers could tell if he would. The real secret diplomacy of the world is that which hands over the world's so-called secrets to a few men who are members of one race. The surface of diplomacy, those activities which get written down in the memoirs of comfortably aging statesmen, those coups and treaties which are given high-sounding fame, as if they were really important, that is incomparable with the diplomacy of Judah and its matchless enginery for worming out the hidden knowledge of every ruling group. The United States is included in all these statements. Perhaps there is no government in the world so completely at their service as is our own at the present, their control having been gained during the past 5 or 6 years.
Now, that's interesting. And they're talking about spies, right? All their spies?
He's talking about the advance of Jewish power under the Wilson administration, for the most part. Mm-hmm. They made a lot of money during the First World War. They talk early in the International Jew about the fact that the Jews gained advantages through participation in the war bureaus. Mm-hmm. Got a lot of inside information, I guess, that they still were using.
Okay, so they say that no government in the world so completely at their service as our own at present. Perhaps there's no government in the world. What are they talking about? That they're the government? No, there's no government in the world so completely at the service of the United States, or at the service
at the service of the Jews. The United States government is serving the Jews.
United States government is serving the Jews. Okay.
More than any other government.
That's what I thought it should be, but it seemed like it was kind of hard to make that out from that. Okay. Yeah, well, now there you go. Already, they said the United States government is doing our bidding, and it's not the other way around.
Yeah. I think that was reversed for a while during the 1920s, but then when Franklin Roosevelt came in 1933, that they went back that way.
Hmm.
All right. The protocols do not regard the dispersal of the Jews abroad upon the face of the earth as a calamity, but as a providential arrangement by which the world plan can be the more certainly executed, as see these words of the 11th protocol.
God gave to us, his chosen people, as a blessing, the dispersal, and this which has appeared to all to be our weakness has been our whole strength. It has now brought us to the threshold of universal rule.
The claims to accomplishment which are put forth in the 9th protocol would be too massive for words, were they too massive for concrete realization. But there is a point where the word and the actuality meet and tally.
In order not to destroy prematurely the Gentile institutions, we have laid our efficient hands on them and rasped the springs of their mechanism. They were formerly in strict and just order, but we have replaced them with a liberal, disorganized, and arbitrary administration. We have tampered with jurisprudence, the franchise, the press, freedom of the person, and most important of all, education and culture, the cornerstone of free existence. We have misled, stupefied, and demoralized. I just jumped. Where did I go? Oh, I jumped way up. This is terrible. I'm so sorry. We have misled, stupefied, and demoralized the youth of the Gentiles by means of education in principles and theories patently false to us, but which we have inspired. Above existing laws, without actual change, but by distorting them through contradictory interpretations, we have created something stupendous in the way of results. You see, they're still using the present tense, we have.
Perfect tense, actually.
Well, perfect tense.
Yeah. Everyone knows that in spite of the fact that the air was never so full of theories of liberty and wild declarations of rights, there has been a steady curtailment of personal freedom. Instead of being socialized, the people under a cover of socialistic phrases are being brought under an unaccustomed bondage to the state. The public health is one plea. Various forms of public safety are other pleas. Children are hardly free to play nowadays, except under playmasters appointed by the state, among whom, curiously enough, an astonishing proportion of Jews managed to find a place. The streets are no longer as free as they were. Laws of every kind are hedging upon the harmless liberties of the people. A steady tendency toward systematization, every phase of the tendency based upon some very learnedly stated principle, has set in. And curiously enough, when the investigator pursues his way to the authoritative center of these movements for the regulation of the people's life, he finds Jews in power. Children are being lured away from the social center of the home for other centers. They are being led away, and we are speaking of Gentile children, no Gentiles are ever allowed to regulate the lives of Jewish children, from their natural leaders in home, church, and school to institutionalized centers and scientific play spots under trained leaders, whose whole effect, consciously or unconsciously, is to lead the modern child to look to the state instead of its natural environment for leadership. All this focuses up to the world plan for the subjugation of the Gentiles. And if it is not the Jewish world plan, it would be interesting to know why the material for it is so largely Gentile children and the leaders of it so often the Jewish race.
And I know you probably want to keep reading and finish this up, but, you know, if this were, well, we're already at the ending. If this were written today, you could say, well, they look around, they see, you know, what's happened. But think again that this was, at least this book was written in 1920 and actually before that a little bit. No, I guess it was chapters in the newspaper 1920. So, and already they're saying that children are being led away from the home and they're, you know, and the Jews are in charge of these, children's organizations that, and there was a lot of movement at that time about how to raise children and, you know, the Dewey School and all that stuff, right?
I think these are tendencies of a complex society and also tendencies of a democracy that you end up getting less freedom. And the Jews are just ahead of the curve on that and anticipating the way things are going and taking advantage of it. I think that's what was happening.
Yeah, you're right. But they were in charge of so many of these organizations at the time. They really were. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have to quit here. We haven't finished chapter 12 yet, but we will finish it next week and then go on to chapter 13.
Hooray, Jake, hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.